He's in Casa Grande. It's sunny and 43 in Flagstaff, sunny and 56 in Tucson. It's 11 o'clock.
Arizona schools were hit hard by the economic downturn and state budget cuts. Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal says increasing K-12 school funding is a good investment.
And that additional dollar flowing into our education system will yield more, much more than a dollar of educational value for society.
I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Hoopenthal about how competitive Arizona schools are and his plans to improve them. Plus, former Senate President Russell Pierce is back in politics, trying to defeat Republican lawmakers who voted for Arizona's Medicaid expansion. Also, Southern Arizona mystery author J.A. Jantz is out with her 50th book. We'll find out what keeps her writing. And the Desert Botanical Gardens turned 75 this week. Its executive director joins me. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. There's more evidence out today questioning the value of routine mammography for women in their 40s and 50s. Here's NPR's Rob Stein.
The new study analyzed data from nearly 90,000 Canadian women in their 40s and 50s. The researchers compared women who underwent annual mammograms with women who only got physical exams. In a paper published in the British medical journal BMJ, the researchers report that the women who got regular mammograms were no less likely to die from breast cancer in 25 years of follow-up. And they were much more likely to undergo treatments such as surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy that may have been unnecessary. The findings are the latest to raise questions about younger women routinely getting mammograms. But the study is unlikely to settle the intense debate about mammography. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The U.S. Senate plans to take up a bill restoring the nation's borrowing authority later today. NPR's Esfi Date reports the clean debt limit increase could then head to President Obama's desk for his signature.
Some Senate Republicans have promised to block the debt limit bill unless it is modified to cut federal spending. But enough Republicans are expected to side with Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid to bring the proposal to the floor, where it could then pass with just Democratic votes. The bill cleared the House Tuesday after Speaker John Boehner abandoned earlier plans to tie a debt limit hike to Republican priorities. Reid thanked Boehner earlier.
The House did the right thing. I believe many of my Republican colleagues would like to be reasonable. I really do believe that. If they weren't so beholden and afraid of their Tea Party overlords.
The federal government technically hit the borrowing cap last week and could default on some bills by the end of the month if Congress fails to act. Esfi Date, NPR News.
Forecasters call it a rare occurrence for southern states, seen once every 10 or 20 years. A massive ice storm is bearing down. Utility crews are out in full force in Georgia, where more than 200,000 people are without electricity. Jim Burris from Emerson WABE is on the scene.
Virtually no one is out. As I look up, I can see Interstate 85, very few cars, maybe one a minute. That's because the roads are virtually impassable. And power lines, this is really what's concerning most officials in the area. Ice is starting to accumulate on those, and they are sagging.
Jim Burris reporting. Icy roads are to blame for an ambulance collision in Texas. Authorities in San Angelo say three people, including the patient and a relative, were killed early yesterday. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was down 36 points at 15,959. NASDAQ up 10 points at 4201. S&P 500 up slightly at 1820. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Vermont Teddy Bear, offering diamonds, chocolates, and roses delivered in the arms of a bear for Valentine's Day at VermontTeddyBear.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The number of Arizona high school students earning college credit based on advanced placement exam scores has nearly doubled over the past decade. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Mark Brody has more.
The new report from the College Board finds nearly 14.5% of Arizona high schoolers scored at least a 3 on an AP exam last year. They're graded on scales of 1 to 5. In 2003, that number was less than 7.5%. That ranking places Arizona 33rd in the country, just behind Rhode Island and Alaska, and just ahead of Washington, D.C. and Idaho. Maryland, Connecticut, Virginia, and Massachusetts led the country. Nationwide, more students and more low-income students are taking AP exams than a decade ago. In Arizona, about a quarter of high school graduates took an AP exam last year. The College Board also says Arizona has improved the number of minorities taking the tests. Mark Brody, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A bill barring local law enforcement from enforcing animal cruelty laws on farms and other livestock operations has been moved forward by an Arizona legislative committee. The bill, sponsored by Representative Brenda Barton of Payson, also requires anyone who has photographic or video evidence of animal cruelty to report to authorities within 5 days. The bill would give all authority to investigate animal abuse claims on farms and other livestock operations to the State Department of Agriculture. An amendment added Tuesday allows the department to coordinate with local law enforcement, but police say that doesn't do enough to restore power to local officers. Bill supporters say it helps free up resources for investigating domestic animal abuse, while animal rights activists say the bill's intent is to stop undercover operations that reveal animal cruelty.
KJZZ is supported by Essence Bakery, located in Tempe and now 3830 East Indian School, featuring breakfast, organic lunches, and specialty pastries, including French macaroons and croissants. More information at EssenceBakery.com.
In the Valley forecast, look for partly to mostly sunny skies today, a high near 80 degrees. We reached 78 for a high yesterday. It'll be mostly clear tonight with a low of 53. Sunny skies tomorrow, a high of 84. It's mostly sunny in Phoenix, 20% relative humidity, and it's 69 degrees at 11:06.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, State Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopenthal gives his perspectives on how K-12 education is doing in Arizona, how improvement will take place, and whether additional state funding is on the way. Arizona Education Association President Andrew Morrow will offer his opinions as well. Plus, on Thursday, the Desert Botanical Garden celebrates its 75th anniversary. Executive Director Ken Schutz will tell us about the DBG's mission and how big an impact the Dale Chihuly in the Garden exhibition has had on attendance. Also, Southern Arizona mystery writer J.A. Jantz just had her 50th book published. We'll find out what keeps her writing and what she thinks of e-books. We start today's program with a name from Arizona's recent past, a man who for a short time dominated the state's political scene, former State Senate President Russell Pierce. He was ousted in a recall election, tried and failed in a comeback, but he has returned, and this time he's not a candidate. Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times wrote about Pierce earlier this week and joins me now. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good. So, why is Russell Pierce back?
Yeah, he is back. He is going to be headlining a fundraiser tomorrow night for a political action committee that is hoping to raise money to primarily challenge to take on and run campaigns against the Republican legislators who backed Governor Jan Brewer in supporting the Medicaid expansion proposal from last year.
So does this indicate the Medicaid expansion votes in 2013 are going to have a big effect in the 2014 legislative races? We've kind of speculated about that.
Well, it certainly indicates that the folks who were opposed to the Medicaid expansion, whether they were legislators or conservative activists, that they are still opposed to it, that they are still upset by it, and that they intend certainly to try to make that a part of the campaign. We'll see at the end of the day how voters feel about it. There were certainly a lot of talk about polling numbers that were done during the midst of the policy debate that showed largely that Republican voters tended to agree with the idea of expanding Medicaid.
Jim, what about State Senate Majority Leader John McComish, who's decided not to run again? There was talk that he was just sort of tired of serving or he was going to go become Justice of the Peace. Can we see any vibe now that Russell Pierce, now we know it's going to get a little bit nastier, any signs that maybe that's why John McComish is not running again?
Well, you know, that was certainly the instant speculation. The timing kind of lent itself to that conclusion. You know, the week before, former chairman of the Republican Party had announced that he was going to run against Senator McComish, and then, 5 days later, Senator McComish said he wasn't going to run again. But the folks I've talked with who were close to him, a number of people said that, this was something that was in the works for a while, that he had initially hoped to announce his retirement before the session began and if possible, by the end of 2013. There were some circumstances that didn't allow for that, and so the result was kind of a middle to the end of January announcement on that.
Jim, let's come back to Russell Pierce. So obviously the folks with the Arizona Taxpayers Action Committee think he will help raise some money. Who does he appeal to these days?
I think he appeals to a lot of the same folks within the Republican Party that he's appealed to since the very beginning of his political tenure in Arizona. It's people who primarily identify currently with the Tea Party, but for a long time have identified as, the constitutional Republicans or folks whose focus is on, protecting the taxpayer. That's what this group is all about. It's an offshoot of some other groups that have existed in the past. And really, it's kind of those core grassroots Republican activists who want people to hold a firm line on spending and on illegal immigration and on social issues and things of that ilk.
Jim, what do you know about Russell Pierce? Has it been hard for him to not be in the spotlight? And does this indicate he may, in fact, be a candidate at some point in the future?
Well, that's hard to say. I called former Senator Pierce and didn't hear anything back from him. So I don't know. He was always someone who did definitely relish being in the spotlight. This does kind of mark somewhat of his return since he was defeated as a candidate in 2012. Whether he comes back as a candidate in the future, hard to say. I know he's certainly was at some point looking forward to retirement, but at the same time he's got a drive to be a public servant that has really always kind of kept him involved in one form or another.
And Jim, another maybe broad observation, if you wouldn't mind, how have the workings of the Senate, even the House, overall the legislature changed since Russell Pierce was no longer Senate President?
I think it's changed dramatically, if for no other reason than, he was such a lightning rod, a polarizing figure in Arizona politics. I mean, there was a swath of people who were firmly committed to him and loyal to him no matter what, and a much more vocal, I would say, group of people who were diametrically opposed to him and thought that he represented everything that was wrong with Arizona politics. So when he led the Senate, it really highlighted that division and I think really exacerbated some of those feelings on both sides. With him gone, the legislature in general, I think, is a little bit of a calmer place. It's a little bit that there's not as much. It's not as much of a tinderbox, where you have people's emotions running really high because of one person's personality.
And Jim, finally, is there a hangover in the current session from the fight in the last session over Medicaid?
Yeah, I think that there still is. This year has been a little bit odd so far. We're about a month into the session, and it's been fairly slow and fairly low key. There are some disagreements that are kind of simmering below the surface, but nothing like what we saw last year, where it was almost an all-out battle from day one, and it ended with in such an unusual fashion that it really left a lot of raw nerves. I think people are still trying to figure out how they can work with each other, and we'll see in the next couple months whether that's going to be possible.
Jim Small of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Arizona's K-12 schools were hit hard by the economic downturn, which led to deep budget cuts at the state capitol. Last week, state school superintendent John Hoopenthal, a former lawmaker, gave his 2014 State of Education address. He talked about competitiveness and funding, among other things, and Superintendent Hoopenthal joins me now. How competitive do you think Arizona's K-12 students are compared to the rest of the country?
Well, there's two different ways of looking at that. The main thing that we have to be concerned about is the competitiveness of our school system. Then, as a part of that, you are absolutely concerned about the competitiveness of our students. And we in Arizona face a much higher hill to climb because such a larger percentage of our students come from poverty backgrounds, such a larger percentage come from minority backgrounds, where they enter into the first day of kindergarten far behind the other students. However, granted that, our schools at creating academic gains, we rank somewhere right around 20th, 19th, 18th in the nation in terms of their ability to move students forward academically. So that isn't good enough. The challenge is so much higher here in Arizona. So we need to get up into the top five, first in the nation, if we're going to be able to move our students up into the top 10 of the nation.
What are some steps you think have been taken in your first couple of years in office, and what can be done in the next few years to make that happen?
Well, the major thing, and as I laid it out in the State of Education for Arizona, is continuing to support and advance school choice. We have many schools in Arizona that are among the top 5% of the nation in terms of their quality. And unlike other states, the parents here have access to many choices. So the school choice environment, we see more and more parents migrating to our A schools, and we see more and more schools moving into the A category. So that's what we need to keep healthy, number one. Number two is that we need to keep in mind that the narrowing that is happening in education may not be healthy. And so part of my State of Education speeches was to talk about a robust education system that has the arts, that has career and technical education, that has foreign languages. So we need to define quality in terms of the, you know, your core academic subjects, but we need to also to define it more broadly.
There's been a conversation at the higher education level about students needing their own unique path, and it almost sounds like that's what you're saying with K-12. Is that something that, as part of school choice, you're letting people say, maybe this is not a person who's going to go to a different institute of higher education, but maybe going to a vocational school? Is that something that K-12 schools can be better at?
Absolutely, but I would put a slightly different twist or spin on it than the way that you phrased it. I would say that for some students, our traditional path just hasn't worked for them, and a path which opens up three-dimensional education avenues through career and technical education can potentially do it all for that student, give them an education that motivates them, whereas our current paths do not, but simultaneously one that allows them it grips them with one dimension of motivation that can reach out to the others, that we need to integrate math, and we're working on this. It was a part of the State of Education speech also, where we integrate math learning, we integrate the English language arts into career and technical education, and we get it all. And that's part of our vision for a world-class education.
From talking to you over the years and talking with your predecessor, it seems like your approach is a little bit different in the sense that you look at it from the standpoint of an engineer. You're very data-driven. Is your philosophy being more implemented in what people are doing in the department?
I've spent my entire adult life studying organization theory, and we are doing an excellent job within the department of defining ourselves as an organization. We have 500 employees here, and we have immense capability if we get organized and we really create a culture of service where we're here to support the school districts, support teachers, support principals, superintendents. And in fact, with our measurements, we have all of these entities out here rating the quality of our performance, and we're seeing a steady uptick. And when I go out into the field and I talk to principals, they say it's been marked. They say just last week I was down at Sacaton School District on the Gila River Indian community, and the principal said to me, she said, it's remarkable. She said, when I call your department, knowledgeable people answer, they're willing to help, and they have expertise. And she said, thank you.
It's here and now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with the Superintendent of Public Instruction for Arizona, John Hoopenthal. How much more funding does your department need, and how much more funding do Arizona students need to really be able to compete?
Well, I think what we've succeeded in doing here in Arizona, and the argument that I make to legislators now, is that when you look at all these studies and it shows absolutely no correlation between money and outcomes, and then you look at specific case studies like New York City, where they went from $12 billion spending on one school district to $25 billion without any ascertainable results, and you look at the Kansas City experience, it has produced a tough environment. I argue now, though, through our competitive environment in Arizona and our innovations, that you now can get a return on the investment, and that additional dollar flowing into our education system will yield more, much more than a dollar of educational value for society. So we're making that argument, in fact, and more resources need to flow to education.
Has your perspective on that changed a bit since you've been in this position, opposed to when you were in the legislature?
You know, a little bit. The one shock to me was to fully understand the data system here in the department and how much a cancer it was on our school districts and our schools and our charter schools. It was stunning for me to fully understand that and to realize that there are certain areas where if you put money in, not only are you going to get the full return of your investment, but you're going to get astronomical returns because of the reduction in bureaucracy and paperwork and being able to flow and able to your leadership resources to more intensely focus on the classroom instead of all of the mess that's created by the poorly run government.
So you're talking about spending the money more efficiently.
Oh, absolutely, and understanding where it can truly return a dividend. And I'll tell you, this data system, it's like the brainstem on your brain. It is connected to every teacher, every principal, every special ed director, every business manager. I was stunned to go out there into the school districts and find out all the parallel systems, all the support staff that are working full-time to deal with errors coming out of this. I was in shock. This is intolerable.
Many Arizona teachers feel like they're not regarded well enough. Do you think teachers as a whole are treated well enough, paid well enough?
I think that we, as a culture for a long time, when you have a system of districts in which the lowest performing teacher at the lowest performing school in the lowest performing district is guaranteed a full classroom of students, I think that created an environment in which teachers were not well regarded. In our current environment, when I go in and see a full classroom, and I know that there's 20 charter schools that these parents could have selected for their student, instead they're there, and I can see the manifestation right there of the quality, plus knowing they have options, I think what we're gonna see in coming time, and we're already seeing it at quite a number of our schools, particularly our upper echelon A schools, is that the respect that people have for teachers and the status of teachers in society is going to rise steadily.
For as long as I can remember, at least the last couple of decades, Arizona has been criticized for what's being spent on education, its results. We talked a little bit about spending, but what is it going to take for the state to be more highly regarded consistently among educators across the country? And how fast do you think we could get there? Is this something that could take a decade, could take more? What do you think?
Well, the nature of this beast is you have to be able to look as a policymaker on down the road. And so by looking on down the road over the last two decades, we are now number one in the nation in school choice, by far. I mean, we have 180,000 students attending charter schools, 18%. So number two in the nation is down around 8%. So we're way out in advance there. And I predicted that we would first see our benefits from this in social indicators. And we've seen a stunning drop in juvenile arrest rates and juvenile violent crime as we have increased school choice. My prediction now is that over the next decade, we will see the other dividend come in, which is much higher academic achievement as a result of our choice environment. And we're going to see steadily an understanding of how you train great teachers in a classroom. So we're going to be able to take our average teachers in over a course of years, make them great teachers and raise our teachers that aren't doing an acceptable job now up to an acceptable level. So we will see that kind of transformation in the classroom and the overall environment. The knowledge that parents apply to choosing a school for their child is going to get sharper and sharper in the coming time. And I think part of that's going to be produced by this 18% of our students in choice environments. But also, we have perhaps 200,000 students making a choice of a district school outside of their attendance boundaries. Hmm. So we now have this swirling marketplace in which consumers are getting sharper and sharper and more intelligent about making choices. I think it's going to pay an enormous dividend over the next decade.
Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, John Hoopenthal. I recorded that interview with John Hoopenthal on Tuesday before reports that he'd voiced a robocall telling parents about the possibility of using taxpayer money to send their kids to private schools. Coming up, I'll get the perspectives of Arizona Education Association President Andrew Morrill. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Theater Company, presenting Other Desert Cities, a Pulitzer Prize finalist about a powerful, seemingly perfect family whose daughter reveals the publication of her tell-all memoir. ArizonaTheater.org.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5. BBC News Hour is this afternoon at 1. It's followed by The World at 2, and All Things Considered is at 3. Checking conditions around the state right now. Sunny skies and 47 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 52 in Prescott. Sunny and 64 degrees in Tucson. 64 in Casa Grande and sunny and 76 in Yuma. In Valley traffic on the westbound Red Mountain portion of the Loop 202 freeway, watch out for a crash that's blocking the shoulder at Priest. We have mostly sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 69 degrees at 11:25.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. With me now to talk about education issues in the state is the president of the Arizona Education Association, Andrew Morrill. Andrew, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you with us. I need to get your reaction, first of all, to these reports that Superintendent Hupenthal recorded robocalls talking about the benefits of private schooling.
Well, I think it's very sad, and I take that as much from what's been communicated to me by teachers, other folks in the education community. We've had inquiry after inquiry to the AEA asking, why is Superintendent Hupenthal doing this? Why is a man who was elected out of the public trust to lead and uphold our public education system, clearly drawing his campaign lines, throwing himself over, not into a choice issue, and I'll explain the difference, but really into a market strategy for the profiteering side of education. Because we've had choice in this state for a long time. Parents have always had the choice as to whether or not they wanted to send their students to private schools. We're far beyond choice now, Steve. We're into market strategy, where you try to create the market for your customer base, for your product, and you try to squeeze out others who are delivering the same kind of service, in this case, education.
If this were not an election year, would this have happened?
I don't believe so. I think that Superintendent Hupenthal, he's always been a choice advocate, but as I have said, we're no longer talking about choice. I think he's drawn his line in the sand, and he's crossed over and said that as a candidate, I will embrace the profiteering motives for education. I will embrace and I will choose as my alliance those who see education as a for-profit venture.
Andrew, let's go into more general topics. I want to ask you about how competitive you think Arizona's K-12 students are when it comes to the rest of the country. How do we measure it, and how has that changed since Hupenthal took over for Tom Horn?
Well, I taught high school English in the Marana District down on the northwest side of Tucson for 17 years, and I can tell you that I wrote recommendation letters for my students to some great schools, and not just the Harvards and the Yales, but the Vanderbilts, Drakes, the Drexels, the strong academic institutions around the country. And they got into those schools, and they got in because of a solid education platform that was delivered by classroom teachers, led by administrators that knew how to work and were getting resources from the state. I think that there was in some ways Superintendent Hupenthal has benefited from an arena of fairly low expectations. He was not a champion of public schools when he was in the legislature. He regularly supported tax cuts and then the education funding cuts that almost always followed. But when he became superintendent, he had an open door policy. He seemed to be embracing a lot of the education perspectives. I think he has done a good job of trying to bring together voices. He's done an admirable job, for instance, of talking about why our new academic standards are good for students and why they make sense. And I do offer him credit there. I don't believe he's been a game changer. I don't believe he's been a needle changer. And in part, I think that's because he helped create a very, very rigid, constrictive structure in which our schools operate when he was in the legislature, and he's finding himself unable really to do a lot in that system that he helped create.
Well, that brings us directly to the legislature, which is, in a general sense, do lawmakers care enough about K-12 education, and is that reflected in funding?
I think they do care, Steve. I have a hard time talking about any individual legislator, even some that have been the most, the strongest opponents to education funding. It's hard for me as a father of five to look at another adult and say, you don't care. But then again, we have to look at actions. And unfortunately, anybody's regard is very hard to plot because this state is in a downward spiral and trajectory in terms of its investment into its public schools. And we've seen that year after year. We were the lowest per pupil funded state in 2008, and that's by an objective study of state per pupil funding across the country. Then for the next 5 years, we cut the most out of our general fund budget of any state in the country. So we started out low and we got worse. We know that in the face of increasing expectations at all fronts in education, ramping up expectations for how our students learn, what they learn, how teachers perform in the classroom, we're increasing expectations, but we're lowering our investment strategy. So do people care? I'm sure they do. Have they put their caring into action with a good agenda and budget for schools? Not yet.
Andrew, if there were reasonable funding increases to at least somewhat make up for all the cuts during the worst of the recession, where should that money be spent wisely?
We've got to fund the formulas, fund the formulas, fund the formulas. And what that means is this state, over a period of decades, created a per-pupil formula that addressed the various needs a student would have and the kind of school that could respond to those needs. So into that formula went how we pay people and how we staff schools to have the right amount of staffing and how we pay for facilities. And there was something called a capital funding formula where we derived the calculation for what kind of buildings we would need and how we would modernize those buildings as time went on, how we would put technology in those buildings. And in 2008, we backed away from those, and in successive years we did as well. Now the governor wants to erase the debt of two of those lines, pretend that we don't owe ourselves that money, zero out the debt, and say, well, now we don't owe ourselves, and we have this new badly cut fund for capital. In reality, we're far behind where we need to be. But of all the priorities, I think I would look at full-day kindergarten because it's such a game-changer for the early grades and because we're now requiring our third-grade students to read at grade level before they can progress to the fourth grade. Ironically, we passed that law in the same year that we voted to cut full-day kindergarten funding for our students.
Andrew, why did full-day kindergarten become such a partisan issue? When Janet Napolitano was governor, it seemed like a lot of people were on board, and as soon as she left, it seemed like a lot of people jumped ship.
Because in Arizona, we're so polarized on our issues, including education, that we try to too many folks elected try to figure out how they can do damage to an elected official from the other party by assigning them an issue. And too many people looked at full-day kindergarten as part of Janet Napolitano's agenda. And instead of asking whether or not it was good for students, they said, how can we hurt her? We can hurt her by trying to attack her full-day kindergarten scheme. If we had been doing what was right for students, we would have put full-day kindergarten funding into the formula on a per-pupil basis so that as that went up, we would be able to meet the growth needs of full-day kindergarten funding. We see the same thing going on nationally with people who don't like Obama. They'll associate certain policies with him and say, I don't like those policies. They stop evaluating what's good for students, and they think only about political maneuverings and opposition or support for the people they want in office.
I suppose this is going in the same direction, but what should residents take from the fight over Common Core, even the idea of the name of Common Core?
Yeah, and I have to tell you that I'm one of the few people that really doesn't mind the fact that we changed that name, because I don't think that Common Core inspires anybody. Okay. As an educator of 17 years, I at least understand why you want students prepared for college and career readiness. I don't think that's so bad. The real problem, Steve, with our debate on the standards is we're debating whether or not standards are good for students. I will tell you that they are. In and of themselves, these standards are good. They ask more of students. They ask them to think more critically. They ask them to apply their knowledge in ways that the earlier standards didn't. And about three-quarters of the teachers polled, when they are polled, say that they actually like the content of the standards. But what we're not asking at the policy level is, what do schools and teachers need? What support, what resources to teach in a new way to new levels? And the funny thing is that teachers are being absolutely crystal clear on the needs they have. We just have to have more people listening as they form the budget for the coming years.
Andrew Morrill is president of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, thanks for fitting us in today.
Thank you so much.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. An administrative law judge's hearing continues today into whether Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn illegally coordinated his 2010 campaign with an independent expenditure group. Horn and aide Kathleen Wynne are fighting civil allegations that they worked together to sidestep election laws during his 2010 run for office. An FBI agent this week testified that a chain of emails and cell phone records show Horn talked to Wynne while she worked with a campaign consultant about an ad. Both deny illegally coordinating spending while she ran a committee called Business Leaders for Arizona. Chuck Coughlin, president of Phoenix-based High Ground, has run a lot of campaigns and joins me to talk about Arizona's campaign finance laws and independent expenditure groups. Chuck, so much has been going on this week with the hearings into Tom Horn and whether he illegally coordinated with an independent expenditure group. Give us some general observations. You've been involved in a lot of campaigns over the years. Are Arizona's campaign finance laws complicated?
Yes, I think all campaign finance laws are complicated. Arizonans are going through a fairly dramatic change of themselves. And so those of us that are engaged in the practice of campaigns and actually running them are, you know, lawyering up in terms of trying to keep up with the changes and make sure you stay on the right side of the law. But even when organizations do that, there will, in, as you know, Steve, in any political campaign, there will be accusations back and forth about behaviors which one side will claim are illegal and the other side will say that, no, it's not. You know, and so, yes, and it's getting more complicated by the day.
So, Chuck, since it's getting more complicated, does experience not play as big a part with all the changes? Does that matter as much?
Well, it does. You know, running campaigns is not a lucrative business, really, because if you're actually doing it for the right reason, you want all those resources or a vast majority of those resources to go to voter contact information. But people get into this business thinking it's an avenue. So you have more and more people getting in thinking, well, there's a lot of resources here. And there can be a lot of resources, but often those resources, as I said, most of those resources should go towards voter contact. You don't have a lot of experience in the field now of people who have done this professionally for a long period of time. That coupled with the fact that the laws are changing. And most recently, I think the most interesting thing that's happened in Arizona is we've changed our own individual campaign contribution limits and PAC contribution limits, which I believe on my own point of view is that will diminish to some extent the significance of these IEs, the independent expenditures. Because in the past, independent expenditures really filled a role where there was campaigns that had supporters that wanted to support the campaign, but due to Arizona's very, very low campaign contribution limits, they were funneled, their support got funneled towards an IE. I've always been a person that supported more of the campaign money going to the actual candidate and having those funds disclosed so voters can understand who's supporting a candidate, where the money's coming from, and what they believe, and let candidates either defend or extol the virtues of their contributors.
And Chuck, there are people that are worried about corruption, as always, in campaigns. Do you think if there's more openness in terms of this and the raising of the limits is going to make that less of a problem?
To a degree, it will. I believe in the opening of those disclosure laws. I think Senator Reagan's running a bill in this session of the legislature. I don't know that it will succeed. That would require disclosure on some of these independent expenditures, which are not under disclosure requirements right now. I think that would be better for the electorate. But the big thing here is, and Steve, this is a generic criticism of the coverage of the topic, is we end up chasing our tail rather than talking about where the money's going. And the money in these instances is generally coming from organizations that are vested in the process of partisan politics. And what you find, particularly in primaries, is that most of the money goes to or comes from highly partisan or highly ideologically based organizations. As you know, by experiencing the election in Arizona, we only have like a 20% at a high point of turnout in a primary election. You know, we've done some analysis that there's about 500,000 voters in Arizona that vote in the general elections that don't vote in primaries. Mm. And I think the evolution of this will be towards organizations which are turning out broader civic participation rather than ideologically based participation. You know, we complain today about the entrenched partisan politics that we have, but it's what we vote for. It's what the electorate actually currently votes for in the primary. And people who don't participate in primaries, voters who don't participate in primaries and only participate in generals, I've often said it's like showing up for dinner and getting the, you know, dessert and getting the bill handed to you. the dinner's over 90% of the time by the time the primary's over. What most of these entities are trying to do is promote very partisan participation in a primary. And in Tom's case, getting back to the specifics of it, his opponent in the general in this case was Felicia Rodellini. She also had an independent expenditure campaign. I think it was a Committee for Justice and Fairness. And that spent actually more money than Tom's independent expenditure campaign. So the issue here is coordination, which always is a very, very difficult thing to prove in court without actual paper, a smoking gun, saying this person said this at this time to coordinate with this party. Felicia's independent expenditure campaign was run by the Democratic Attorney General's Association, had widespread support from other people who were involved in her campaign. You know, could you make the accusation that they were coordinating? Sure, but, you know, you can't prove that. And I think that the same thing's going to happen here. I think it's going to be difficult for the court to prove in a court of law that there was actual coordination here on the Horn front.
Chuck, finally, before you go, how much does a candidate in a typical circumstance need to know about groups, what they're doing? Is this odd that a candidate, in the case of Tom Horn, is being accused of having some sort of coordination with a group?
No, it's not odd that the accusation is made. My advice to any candidate who is involved in, you know, is running, that we're running their campaign, is there's absolutely no contact with any other entity that is potentially or has filed as an independent expenditure. You know, there will be the intermittent calls. I get calls during campaigns going, hey, we may be doing this or we may be doing that. I'm like, you can talk to me about that up until the time that you file a committee. Once you file a committee, once that's on board, there can be no further communication. And that's my rule of thumb, you know, just a very bright line. Generally, what you're trying to do is regulate or legislate behavior of people who are supportive of another candidate and saying, you can't talk to them. You cannot have any, you can't talk to them because any discussion could be construed as coordination. And in Tom's case, what Tom is saying is, I was discussing with these people other business transactions. My advice, had I been involved in Tom's campaign, is I think those business transactions should wait until after the campaign.
Chuck Coughlin is president and founder of High Ground Public Affairs Consultants. Chuck, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll mark 75 years of the Desert Botanical Gardens and talk with Southern Arizona mystery writer J.A. Jantz about her 50th book. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Butterfly Wonderland, educating visitors about thousands of different butterflies from around the world in an indoor tropical rainforest environment. Tickets and information at butterflywonderland.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and KJZZ.org. Look for sunny skies across the valley today, a high around 80 degrees. It'll be clear tonight with a low around 53. Sunny and clear for the next several days with a high of 84 on Thursday and 87 on Friday. At 12, we'll have NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, a new study is calling into question the value of mammograms, and residents of the Southeast are getting ready for another massive winter storm. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon. It's 69 degrees under mostly sunny skies. It's 11:44.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Even if most of us have dreamed about writing the great American novel, or any novel for that matter, getting books published doesn't come easily. Mystery writer J.A. Jantz, who lives part of the year in southern Arizona, started writing when she was working at an insurance office. She'd wake up a little early for work and write before getting her kids ready for school. Jantz may have had an unromantic beginning to her writing career, but now, with moving Target in bookstores, Jantz has had 50 books published. She focuses on three different protagonists in her books. J.P. Beaumont is in Seattle, while Joanna Brady and Allie Reynolds are based in Arizona. I asked Jantz how she can write so many books and rotate her lead characters.
The reason I write so many books is, in our family, I write the books and my husband writes the checks. And he can write checks very fast. But the truth is, I love to write. And it's no huge hardship to write the number of books I write. So I guess it's me.
I always wonder if it gets any easier, or does that vary from book to book?
Some books are desperately hard to write. I'll get partway into it, and suddenly the book will come to a halt, and I won't be able to tell where I'm going. Or a book like the last one I wrote, Second Watch, I finished writing the book, but that book had such a big piece of my heart that I couldn't let go of it. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
But no, it doesn't necessarily get easier. You would think that it would, but it does not.
You spend some time in Washington, you spend some time in Arizona. Does that affect how you write and where you're writing, and how often do you write in one place versus the other?
Well, I wrote Remains of Innocence, the next Joanna Brady book, when I was in Seattle.
Okay.
And I often write Beaumont books when I'm in Tucson. It's sometimes easier to create a landscape in words when I'm not looking at it. You have to translate something in something physical into something that readers can see. When I first started writing the Joanna Brady books, I struggled with finding a way to describe the contrast between red shale hills and the gray limestone cliffs. I was doing that in Seattle, and while I was translating that memory of Bisbee into words for readers who had never been there, that I made those connections. But I hear from readers who say, well, I went to Bisbee, or I went to Sedona, and it was exactly the way you described it in the book. Well, I use real places because I'm too lazy to make up stuff.
There are some people who think someone who's as prolific as you are must just sort of be ready to go. It's not about research. It's more about imagination. But there must be some kind of balance there.
Well, in Moving Target, Leland, whose hometown was Bournemouth, which is a place I personally have never been, but I did a lot of research about Bournemouth. But at the end of the book, when Allie asks him, is there any place else he'd like to go? He wants to go to Stonehenge. And I went to Stonehenge in 1970 and walked the 8 miles from Salisbury to Stonehenge on foot. When I went there, you could still walk up and touch the stones, and I did. It wasn't until after I wrote this book, I found out that they put in this huge visitor center near Stonehenge now and closed off the roads that I used, I walked to get there, and that Leland's family would have used to drive there. So sometimes I use my memory, and sometimes my memory is no longer accurate.
There are some successful, well-known authors who've turned to self-publishing because that's a way for them to get the books out even faster to readers, not have to go through the publishing machine. Have you ever thought about that?
Detailed editing work is something a publisher offers. Setting up a book tour, the publisher has publicity folks to set up those tours. Now, it's a learning curve. It has taken time for me to convince New York City that you can't do something in Sun City and be in Apache Junction half an hour later. That doesn't work. The danger with a successful publisher going off to publish on his own is he has ebooks now. But what about the people who are readers who wouldn't touch an e-book with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
How does he reach those folks? Last year, when I did Wrong, an e-book novella that's a Beaumont prequel that came out with in conjunction with Second Watch, I insisted that they do a paperback edition of that. And it's just a skinny little book, cost $3, but there were people who wouldn't read it on a computer. They wanted to have the Dead Tree copy. So I think the danger of going strictly ebooks means that you lose the tried and true Dead Tree readers, and I don't want to do that.
Big book tours are a lot less prevalent than they used to be, and yet you go on pretty big book tours frequently. Would you prefer if they were smaller, or does going out on book tours energize you in some way?
It does energize me, and when there are rooms full of people, yes, it energizes me. But there are some bookstores that say they want something. I went to an event in Kentucky last September's Second Watch tour. The manager of the bookstore had the unmitigated gall to stand up and pat himself on his back and say what a wonderful job he was doing in having this event available for his customers, when there were 9 people in the room and 3 of them were from my database. I was not impressed. When you get to talk to rooms full of people, as I do in the Phoenix area, because those people, the people who are snowbirds, those are my demographic. And they like the fact that I write books that are PG-13 without terrific amounts of blood and gore and violence. But they also like the fact that my characters have aged in place, that they're not superheroes, they're sort of regular people heroes. And my position is there are a lot of regular people heroes in this world.
Author J.A. Jantz, her 50th book, Moving Target, has just been published. She spends part of the year in southern Arizona, and she'll be in the Valley next week for several stops. Her first will be a week from Thursday at the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. The desert lifestyle is a unique one, especially the climate that envelops the area. That leads to plants and flowers that most people from across the country and around the world have never experienced before. That, in turn, has helped the Desert Botanical Gardens in Phoenix become a popular destination for tourists and locals. Later this week, the DBG marks its 75th anniversary with a luncheon celebration. Its executive director, Ken Schutz, joins me. Ken, what was the original mission of the DBG, and has it evolved at all?
The garden started in the 1930s. It took a couple of years to really get things going, and our official dedication was on February 12th of 1939. And it's amazing, really, compared to other gardens, that our mission is exactly the same today as it was then: conservation, education, research, and exhibition of desert plants, and especially the Sonoran Desert. What made us unique way back then was the focus on conservation. There weren't many people in Phoenix. There were only 50,000 or so. But even then, they were mostly folks who had moved here from the East and the Midwest, and they wanted to bring their plants, especially the ornamentals, with them. And they didn't really like desert plants. So our founders loved desert plants, and one of their slogans, their mottos in founding the garden, was not to destroy but to glorify. So, and that meant desert plants. So we started as a conservation garden, as a corner of Papago Park where not only desert plants but desert habitats could be preserved. And that continues today to be one of the four pillars of our mission.
And Ken, how important has that location been? It just seems like, even today, such an ideal spot.
Yeah, it's an incredible community asset. What many people don't realize is that in the 1930s, Papago Park was way out there. There's just a dirt road from downtown Phoenix. And the site was selected because the land was available from the state and because it's so absolutely beautiful. The buttes of Papago Park provide the perfect backdrop for the garden and the zoo and as a recreation spot. So ever since the garden started, being in Papago Park has been special and part of the experience of what people really appreciate the garden beyond the plants is the natural setting and the beauty of the landscape.
How has the DBG's attendance, its reputation, been affected by having the Dale Chihuly exhibits or teaming up with Ballet Arizona for Topia, for example?
Dale Chihuly is an amazing artist, one of the few artists that I know of who is popular and successful financially in his own lifetime. And every garden in the country would love to have a Dale Chihuly exhibit because of the impact on attendance. It's just so incredible. We're going to see a doubling of our attendance this year from about 450,000 to nearly 900,000 folks. And that exposure of both local residents and tourists to the Sonoran Desert, to the garden, to our collection, to the mission is so critical. So some people come to see the glass and then come back again because they fell in love with the plants when they were here for the first time. And we found that there's a lasting effect. We call it the Chihuly bump. So once Chihuly has been here, there's a lasting effect in terms of membership and attendance and even number of hits, we call them, that we get in the media. It helps put the garden, the Desert Botanical Garden, on the map and then keep it there. Topia also, it was theater style, so there were only 400 to 500 people per night that could visit. So the absolute numbers were much smaller, but it was such a glorious production. The creative genius of Ebe Anderson programming an outdoor ballet at the garden just maximized both the beauty of the dancers and the beauty of the environment in a way that I'm not aware of has been done anywhere else in the world. So just the lasting impression for both organizations of what can be done with dance and how nature can be viewed through different eyes is a legacy that people still ask me about when I meet them for the first time. Oh, that Topia, will you bring that back? So it's had a very profound impact.
I'd like to ask you as well about the more general evolution. You've been in the Valley for more than a decade. People think about places like Desert Botanical Gardens. I'll even throw in something like the Phoenix Art Museum. The evolution that we've seen in the cultural choices here and the quality of the cultural choices, what have you seen?
Well, I think the arts and culture sector is really strengthening throughout the Valley, and certainly the garden and our colleagues in the arts and culture sector, the Phoenix Art Museum, the ballet, the zoo, and many others, and the appearance in recent years of MIM, all of that has made Phoenix more of an arts and culture destination. So all of us are, when any one of us does well, all of us are stronger. And as more folks come, there's a snowball effect. I think each time we do well and bring new visitors or repeat visitors to one institution, to the sector, it has almost that viral effect that next year you can expect more to come. And I think we're ready to crash through and be recognized as a sector, arts and culture in its broadest definition, as a major spot, especially in the West, but in the nation as well.
Ken, everyone wants to know what the next Dale Chihuly exhibit's going to be or who the next Dale Chihuly is. Can you give us some enlightenment on that?
Every garden director in the country is looking for the next Chihuly. And there are a couple of rising artists, I can't say their names yet, but that are beginning to be discovered by the garden world. And we hope to have a new light artist who will display his work in the evenings in the fall of 2015 and the spring of 2016. But right now we're still in negotiation, so it's not a done deal.
Ken Schutz, he's executive director of the Desert Botanical Gardens, which on Thursday will officially mark its 75th anniversary. And that is it for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg for his help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear any parts of this show or any previous editions, go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also get the KJZZ app and listen to the program as a podcast. Now it's time to return to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Dignity Health, with an online ER waiting service at its member hospitals, St. Joseph's, Chandler Regional, and Mercy Gilbert. DignityHealthArizona.org.